It changed his experience in this place from thinking it was a place where he would always feel alienated, where everyone around him was cruel, to a place where he says he feels as much belonging as to his original home in Syria.
Welcome to The Lisa Show, where we take a good look at life. Hey, it's Lisa. As you may know, I grew up in the sprawling metropolis of Lincoln, Nebraska. I love Nebraska. I mean, where else can you visit the National Museum of Roller Skating and then grab a Runza sandwich with crinkle fries dipped in fresh ranch? Nebraska is great, but the best part of Nebraska was the people I met there, and I want you to meet one of them today. Wendy Perlman was one of my dear friends growing up in Lincoln. Her family moved in on the next street over when we were in junior high, and Wendy and I started walking to school together every day. We became dear friends over the years. We even started a little tradition on the way to school that we called Pop-Tarts and Politics, where we'd solve the world's problems over a frosted strawberry Pop-Tart with sprinkles.
Where do we begin, huh?
I don't even know.
Where we began.
Prepping for this, yeah. Where we began. In like junior high and high school and Pop-Tarts and Politics. And here you've taken the Pop-Tarts and Politics to a totally another level.
I don't know about the Pop-Tarts, but the politics follows you whether you want it or not.
Well, and I just remember you always like doing, being part of Amnesty International in high school. Like you're the one that told me what that was. I didn't know what it was. I remember because you two sent you a signed photo and I was like, hey, how do you get one of those? And you're like, oh, this old thing, no big deal.
No, I mean, I discovered it in junior high and also, you know, my world was smaller. It was the radius of a few blocks from where we lived in Lincoln, Nebraska. And
I know, you lived right around the corner from me.
Yep,
and
sure
thing. And thank goodness that you moved in. We had some really great memories and
absolutely. Absolutely. If it wasn't for you, I would never have gone to high school because I mooched a ride with you every single morning.
No.
I wouldn't have gotten there otherwise. I never would have gone to high school, no less graduated from high school. I owe my entire education to you.
I'll take it. Yeah, sure. Believe me, I would love to take credit for Wendy's education. After high school, she went to Brown University, was a Fulbright scholar, got a master's at Georgetown, and then earned a PhD in political science from Harvard. Yeah, I know, a real slacker. In fact, at high school reunions, Wendy is known as the Lincoln rock star. Wendy is amazing, and I'm still blessed to stay in touch with her. Wendy knows a lot of things that I don't know, especially about the Middle East. I've never been there, and most of the things I hear about that part of the world are from social media. And I'll be honest, the more I hear, the less I feel like I really know. But I also believe that part of living a good life is staying informed and responsible to each other. That's why I wanted to turn to a friend I could trust to help me better understand the world with some boots on the ground insight. I figured you would appreciate that perspective too. Now, I know you don't come here for political commentary from me, so that's not what this is going to be. Instead, I just want you to join Wendy and me for a conversation about her experience in Syria and with Syrian refugees. It's shocking at times, but it's also very inspiring. Wendy has some great advice about what every one of us can do to bridge the gaps between us and the people and events that are foreign to us. So grab a Pop-Tart and let me introduce my friend Wendy to you. You've done so much. You have some very amazing degrees and experiences and books that you've written. But when you meet someone, how do you introduce yourself?
My name is Wendy Perlman. I'm a professor at Northwestern University, focusing on Middle East politics.
I'm really curious about what really led you to researching conflict in the Middle East. Of all the things.
So I would say that I maybe discovered politics and international politics and the ideas of human rights, especially in middle school in Lincoln, Nebraska, with none other than Lisa Valentine Clark.
Shout out to the Irving Aardvarks.
We grew up together in Lincoln, Nebraska. Yep. And I kind of fell upon the organization Amnesty International. And I don't think I had any real political consciousness before then. I always say that I kind of wasted my early childhood in gymnastics, which I did several hours a day, and there was nothing else in my world besides gymnastics. And when I stopped gymnastics, I needed to reinvent myself and discover the world outside the gym. and sort of fell into Amnesty International and became a member of the local chapter in Lincoln, Nebraska, and then went on and became active in it in high school and so forth. I didn't think much about the rest of the world to discovering that the world was larger and that there were countries in which basic things I took for granted, like the ability to speak, to be able to participate in politics, to think that government represents you, that there are basic rights that are protected by law, were not things to be taken for granted anywhere. And in large parts of the world, people didn't enjoy with such freedoms and rights and protections. So Amnesty International is a human rights organization that, especially at that time, really focused on prisoners of conscience, people who were arrested for their beliefs or their peaceful activities. The fact that this even existed, that people could be arrested for speaking or for speaking out or for meeting or for writing something, was kind of mind-blowing for me and grabbed me in a way, grabbed my interest, grabbed me personally, politically, and I became quite active in that through junior high and high school. And that was a kind of awakening of my political consciousness. I didn't have any interest in the Middle East or probably even know that the Middle East existed. And it was just not a part of my world and my experience. And then I went on to college. And like many undergraduates, I decided to do a junior year abroad. I'd actually never traveled outside the United States until that time. And when it came time to choose where to go for my junior year abroad, I said I wanted to go to Africa because I felt like the entire continent of Africa was particularly unrepresented in my world experience growing up where I did. And I started looking at programs and saw that there was a program in Morocco, in North Africa. And I had studied Spanish in high school and a bit in college. And I decided that if I did a semester in Morocco, in North Africa, I could also do a semester in Spain and basically have two very different experiences on the cheap, because I could have a single plane ticket that could take me to Spain and then I could take the boat to Morocco and I would have a semester in Europe and a semester in North Africa and see a lot of the world very quickly. So it was in Morocco that I started studying Arabic and I started to understand something called the Arab world. I came back to university and continued studying Arabic, continued studying the Middle East, eventually moved from North Africa, one corner of the Arab world, more eastern into the kind of heart of the Middle East. And I've basically been doing it ever since. So that was about 30 years ago. And Arabic language has been a part of my life since then. Studying the Middle East has been a part of my life. I went on to do a master's degree and then a PhD in political science focusing on the Middle East. And now I teach it and research it for a living.
With a Middle East expert in my midst, I wanted to know what blind spots Wendy finds in Westerners like me, especially in how we perceive the Syrian conflict and its refugees. Wendy helped me see that a huge part of understanding refugees' stories is understanding the context of how Syrians became refugees in the first place. I don't pretend to know everything that has been happening in Syria, so if you're like me, a quick refresher might be helpful. Wendy shared some key facts about the country and its refugees to get me up to speed.
I began studying Syria in 2011 with the Arab uprisings and what became the Syrian uprising or the Syrian revolution, which was a mass unarmed protest movement to dislodge the authoritarian regime that had existed in Syria since 1970 and went through many different phases of uprising, of war, of mass repression by a brutal regime that used every imaginable weapon against its own population. And now there's finally a chance at a political transition in Syria. But in the course of that, more than half of the Syrian population was forced to flee their homes. So some 14 million people of the population of 22 million. And about half of those became refugees all over the world, although the majority remained in countries on Syria's borders. Syria went from a revolution to war to displacement. And all of a sudden, I was studying refugees and spending a lot of time in refugee communities and trying to understand their experiences. People had never expected that they would have to flee, but they also had to flee to save their lives and avoid being killed, and then found themselves in places where they maybe never even imagined they would step foot, having to learn new languages, having to build new lives, maybe having to go back to school, maybe having to reinvent their professions entirely, and that affected every aspect of life. For me, it was always important to put their experiences as refugees in this larger context. People didn't necessarily see themselves as refugees. If they saw themselves as refugees, it wasn't their first and most important identity. As one person put it to me, this is a person who was a refugee in Germany,
yeah,
saying a refugee is not a kind of person. It's a type of situation. Any person could become a refugee if there was war or mass instability in their country and they had to leave in order to survive. So just the process of talking to people who have had to endure this incredible challenge, as Syrians always put it to me, starting life over, not at zero, but from below zero, has always encouraged me to try to put myself in those shoes and say, would I have had the courage to keep going forward? Not simply to survive, but to thrive as so many people have. And that is in addition to just the challenges of moving forward in a new place.
Right.
No less the challenge of looking backwards to your own home that maybe no longer exists, to a country that has been destroyed, that is rubble, of having to cope with having watched family members be killed, of having to cope with maybe having gone to prison and being tortured for your beliefs. And one of the things that's the most painful things in the Syrian context is there are nearly 200,000 people who are missing to this day. They've been arrested and their family members do not know if they're alive or dead. If dead, they don't know how they were killed or where their bodies are. And the huge majority of these are people who are arrested by the government and thrown into prisons and never heard from again. And these families have this open wound of not even being able to grieve and mourn because they've reached no closure. So the people that we see as displaced people and refugees, and we see maybe just in the West, that is, maybe just see the part of their hardship that relates to them trying to make it in our societies, which is a huge part of challenges that people are dealing with. But there's this whole other challenge and all these other wounds we don't even see.
That's so very well said. I appreciate that perspective. You've had the opportunity to interview many of these refugees. How many do you think you have over the course of your studies?
I began following Syria in 2011, and I began doing interviews in 2012. And I mean, I have a long Excel spreadsheet where I try to keep track of these things.
I bet you do.
And I think I've interviewed like over 550 individuals at this point in an interviewing project that's now over 13 years. And that's taken me really around the world. I've interviewed people in Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey, where the majority of Syrian refugees are, across Europe. I started doing interviews over Zoom, so that got me to places like Japan and Brazil and Sudan. And then I went to Syria this summer, which was incredibly special. I mean, this was a place that when I began studying it, I never thought that I would step foot because it was under this cruel dictatorship. And when it was overthrown in December 2024, I got to watch as many of my Syrian friends and colleagues and interlocutors went back to their hometowns and were reunited with family and saw their countries and saw their homes. And I followed that from afar for many, many months. And then I myself went in August, and it was an incredible opportunity to be there and begin doing interviews with not just the people who had left, but also the Syrians who stayed and never left. And in many ways, their stories are in some ways even more tragic because they endured a country whose economy is in complete shambles. They endured an incredible oppression and repression. And as difficult and horrific has been the experience of so many refugees, in many ways, those who never left Syria even sometimes had it worse. So their stories are now the ones that I think are important to capture. Because for so many of us who've watched Syria from afar, our understanding of the country has been shaped by those who left. Refugees were the easier folks to access and to talk to. And inside Syria was kind of off limits. And now is slowly the time to see what they suffered all of these years of war.
And what did you learn from that trip that changed the way that you maybe saw Syrians and also just that was personally meaningful to you?
Oh, I don't even know where to begin. I was there for almost a month and I'm still processing it. And I always think of it this way, that I spent 13 years studying Syria from afar, and Syria had become imaginary for me. It was a place that I knew through the stories of the people I was talking to, their stories, their memories. I did not have a relationship to the place as an actual place, as an actual live society. It was something that lived in my mind through words. So I went with the purpose of seeing people and seeing places, but also beginning to kind of tether this imaginary place to a reality. So when I first got there and I was like, oh, look at there are people crossing the street and there are people going to the grocery store and there are traffic jams and there are stores. I'd never taken more photos in my life because I was taking photos of everything. I was like, oh, it's a garbage can in Syria. Oh, it's a tree and it's a tree in Syria. I just wanted to document everything because I was amazed that I was actually there. But there's so much. It's a country that's going through an extreme transition after 54 years of rule by a single family. It is now in this new political reality where there is a new government and some people are very supportive of the government and other people are extremely critical of the government. And some people are very optimistic about the chances of change. And others are extremely pessimistic. And there are good signs and there have been horrific signs of flat-out massacres of civilians that have happened, especially in March in the coastal areas of Syria and in July in southern Syria. So there is so many reasons to be fearful. At the same time, after 54 years in which change seemed impossible, there is at least the possibility of change and for influencing the country to go on a better path. So it's a time that's incredibly dynamic. It's always changing. People are really polarized. They're figuring out how to act politically and speak politically. And there are lots of debates and lots of disagreements. And it's a lot to try to make sense of.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
You know, of all the stories, and this is maybe not a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there a story from a particular refugee that has just stayed with you or that maybe encapsulates your heart of what you are trying to do of telling these stories?
So I've written two books of interviews with Syrians. The first book came out in 2017 called We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. And the second book is kind of a follow-up that was published in 2024 called The Home I Work to Make. And they're both just collections of interviews. So it's kind of an oral history format where it goes name, story, and there's just a collection of voices. And the first book covers the uprising and war and ends with people leaving Syria, the stories of beginning to leave Syria. And the second book starts with stories of leaving Syria and then kind of follows refugees' journeys around the world as they think about the meaning of home and think about searching for home and losing home and building home and believing in home or maybe not believing in home. So the second book really gets into more stories about how people find their way when they've been forced to flee. One of the speakers in that book is a man named Okba. And Okba did not actually intend on leaving Syria. He was going back and forth between Syria and Turkey because he was involved in a civil society organization. He was doing trainings in Turkey. And while he was in Turkey doing one training, conditions changed and he realized he couldn't go back. So he found himself in Turkey, suddenly a displaced person, unable to return to Syria. And then he slowly makes his way from Turkey to Europe. He thinks he's going to the Netherlands, and he is essentially arrested on a train in Germany. He gets out in Germany and has been in Germany ever since. And he first gets to Germany, and he's very eager to try to make friends. He had been involved in different volunteer activities, and he wants to try to make a difference. He's living in a refugee shelter in a small village, and he doesn't even know how to begin. And he says he turns to Google and tries to find the local church because he thinks, well, maybe I'll find the church and talk to a minister or a priest and he'll be able to help me figure out how to get involved. And he tries and he sends an email and it's never responded to. And then he says, okay, I'm just going to go to the church on Sunday and maybe I'll try to make friends. And he goes there and he's very shy and people come and go from the church and he doesn't even know how to break the ice to talk to people. And finally, he gets up the nerve and he asks someone and asks, is the priest here? Because I would like to get in touch with him. And this woman looks at him quite coldly and says, oh, are you staying in the refugee shelter that everyone knows? And she says, are there women and children there? And he says, no, they're mostly young men like me. And then she walks away. And he gets the message that people might be interested in women and helping women and children, but they're not interested in helping young men. And he goes through several other times when he gets up the courage to try to connect with people. And he just feels like the door is slammed in his face. People aren't interested. They respond very coldly. And he finally says, I give up. It's so hurtful and it's so hard to try to reach out to people. And when it's not reciprocated, it's just too painful. I'm not even going to try to contact anyone. And he lives his life that way until unexpectedly someone says hello to him on the street. And he says that hello changed everything. It was the first person who looked at him with any kind of warmth and kindness. And when he was just about to give up on German society, this person opened a new door. Through him, he's able to finally connect to the priest. He goes to church that one day. They give him the microphone. He speaks in front of the entire church congregation, who suddenly is so kind and welcoming. And then from there, he begins to meet people and meets an older woman whose husband had just died and needed some help moving furniture because she was consolidating her home with her daughter's home. And that begins an entire new relationship. And he comes to call this woman grandma. The grandma says, you know, when I was in this dark time after my husband just passed away, God sent me a new Syrian son. And they become extremely, extremely close. And she becomes his German family to the point where I ask him in the end, you know, where he thinks of home. And he says, of course, my parents are in Syria. I miss them terribly. But if I ever were to go back to Syria, I'd miss my German family that I've met now, like grandma and the other people in the small town. I mean, there's so many stories, but this for me symbolized the power of a single hello, of a single act of kindness, of not even having to do a whole lot and make huge sacrifices. Just a smile on the street, a hello, a short conversation. It changed his experience in this place from thinking it was a place where he would always feel alienated, where everyone around him was cruel, to a place where he says he feels as much belonging as to his original home in Syria. So we all have that capacity to look at a stranger or look at someone who's different than us with a hello, with a smile. It costs nothing. It requires very little energy. It requires very little work or time or money or anything. We can all do this. We can all respond to strangers with the simplest kind of kindness. And we don't know how that can affect people. It could literally change lives.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that story. Oh, I'm going to remember that for a long time. I'm curious as to advice that you give to different individuals and communities that you speak with who want to build bridges across political and cultural divides. What advice do you give them?
Just to listen. Simply to listen. You know, I think that so many disagreements or even hatreds come from assumptions or stereotypes or ways in which we think we know who others are, what they want, what motivates them, and can fill in with all these typically bad accusations. And then when you actually listen to someone express their own point of view, explain who they are, why they think the way they do, there's so much more space for mutual understanding. Mutual understanding breaks down when we assume who others are rather than actually listening to them explain it for themselves. There's this magic that happens when people narrate their lives. It's incredibly powerful and special.
I love what you have to say about storytelling and the power of storytelling. And I think that is something that everybody can relate to. And I wonder, how would you tell the everyday person to stay informed and to make that personal connection that would otherwise and oftentimes feels overwhelming, and to not be desensitized to human suffering, but to be able to make an impact where we can? How do you suggest that we stay informed?
Any way you can put a human face and a human life to the event and then hold that with you, whether it's in the way that news is reported or in videos or in human conversations, whatever it takes to never lose sight of the human, I think is the key. Never lose touch with the human. These are real people.
Over the course of our conversation, Wendy gave me a lot to consider when it comes to Syria and its refugees. But I think the thing I appreciate most is that she helped me understand that every political conflict, whether it's in Gaza or Ukraine or your local city council chambers or your family dinner table, every political divide at the end of the day comes down to people, real people. People like you and people like me. If we're worried about blind spots, the first place we should look is right in front of us. It's saying hello to an unfamiliar face, being kind, asking a question or two. This isn't rocket science. It isn't complicated. And it isn't even time-consuming. It's just basic humanity. You know, as a parent, I take great pains to accept my kids with open arms and an open mind. You'd be amazed at how anxious I am to converse with them and how well I listen to their opinions, even when they're drastically different than my own, because I want to have a relationship with them. I know I'm not alone in this, right, parents? And then it dawned on me that if we gave a fraction of that kind of time and care to the people around us, whether they be from Germany or Syria or the street over in Nebraska, our world would be a very different place.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, hosted by Lisa Valentine Clark. This episode was produced by Erica Price with help from Becca Hurley-Long, Blake Morse, and Kenny Mears, with post-production by Gracie Davis. Special thanks to today's guest, Wendy Perlman. Wendy is a professor of political science at Northwestern University. Links to her books will be in the show notes. Don't miss out on two other great podcasts from the Lisa Show family, The Council of Moms and Proofread, a new book review podcast to help you read more of what you love. You can find The Council of Moms and Proofread on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for your messages. We read them all, and thanks for listening.
Do you find yourself avoiding the news because of how depressive and divisive it all seems, but you still want to stay informed on important issues? Then let me introduce you to Top of Mind, a BYU Radio original podcast just for you. Each episode, the Top of Mind team takes on one tough topic and dives deep, exploring both sides of the debate and finding common ground. Listening to Top of Mind will help you clarify your own views while challenging your way of thinking. In a polarizing world, Top of Mind is about developing empathy for others and their perspectives and staying informed about current topics in a positive, honest, and thought-provoking way. Top of Mind gives you tools to become an effective citizen and kind neighbor while also learning how to be an advocate for the things that matter most to you. Hosted by award-winning journalist Julie Rose, every episode will leave you feeling empowered and hopeful. Listen to Top of Mind on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.